Welcome to this episode of Another World is Potable. My name is Peter Bloom, and get ready to emancipate your mind and radically expand your imagination as we present all the most exciting and revolutionary possibilities of our times, both locally and globally. I hope you enjoy it, and as always, solidarity today, tomorrow, and forever. Welcome to a new episode of Another World is Potable. So I'm really just honored to have Professor Gerald Horn here as my guest tonight. I think he probably needs no introduction to most of my listeners, but for those who don't know him, he's written some of the most important books. And, you know, I mean, for someone so prolific to seemingly every time he writes a book, have it be so quality and so groundbreaking is such an accomplishment. But I really feel he's been one of the, you know, key people in helping us rethink what we sometimes consider is our dominant history, and therefore allowing us to radically change it. So Professor Horn, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
I guess I'll just start with a very simple question before getting into things a bit more complex is, you know, you've written about so much, you know, from the Watts riots all the way to jazz to, you know, very deep histories of the long 16th century and settler colonialism. So what is your kind of intellectual and political background, and how did you kind of take on such a wide range of interests as a historian and scholar and activist?
Well, I think it sort of happened by accident, as these things tend to occur. That is to say that I was living in New York and working as a lawyer and engaged in political activism. And then I decided that in terms of my political activism, I felt it was hampered by what I considered to be misconceptions about the nature of the country in which I was operating, which was the United States of America. So initially I decided to go into graduate school and write about anti-communism, write about radicalism, etc. And at a certain point, I felt that that really wasn't doing the job, that I had to keep going back in time. And if you look at the list of books that I've written, you'll find that I started with the late 20th century, and now I'm back to the 16th century.
Yes.
And because I think, in trying to understand the settler colonial project in the United States, which has been bathed in so much propaganda, that it's necessary to keep going back to the origins of the project, which is what I've done in my latest book.
And I think that's a really important point to kind of bring out, is that I found, you know, both within the U.S. and outside the U.S., is that even within kind of radical discourses, there still is an attachment to this kind of ideological American dream where we are in the midst of an enlightenment project of progress. And you hear a lot of things like the unfinished revolution, or, you know, the Constitution and Declaration are incomplete projects that we have to, you know, oftentimes through quite revolutionary action, you know, finish. However, through really painstaking research, and I think, you know, for people, you know, there's I would recommend almost all your books, but one really accessible and incredible book that started with the Counter-Revolution of 1776, you actually show that from the very beginning, the U.S. project was an interesting mix of liberal emancipatory ideas with quite strong white supremacist reactionary tendencies, and not just about trying to negotiate, oh, well, some of us have slaves and let's see how long it takes us to phase it out, but quite literally, we need a revolution because it looks like abolitionist movements are happening globally and they may take our right to own Black bodies and use them for exploitative purposes. So I was wondering, when you're able to rethink the American or the U.S. project in that way, how does that help us then rethink what we need to do as activists and political thinkers, especially as we engage in struggles and try to have more organized revolutionary change?
Well, I think the short answer is internationalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly that has been the savior for Black people in North America. I mean, I shudder to think where we would be without the international community. Well, it's clear that the international community has been extraordinarily helpful to alleviate the plight of Black people in particular, and to a certain degree, indigenous populations as well. And I think part of the reason is that too many in the Euro-American community, the so-called white American community, have either been participants in class collaboration or rationalizers of class collaboration. What I mean is in my 16th century book, where I go back to the origins of the invasion of North America by the English, first in the 1580s in what is now the Carolinas, and then in 1607 in what they call Virginia, supposedly named after the alleged Virgin Queen. Was a class collaborationist project. The settlers from diverse backgrounds. And then what's happened subsequently is that many, even radicals, they tend to rationalize class collaboration by coming up with really threadbare arguments for how the descendants of the settlers vote, for example. Like, for example, the vote for Donald J. Trump in 2016, 63 million votes. It's mathematically impossible for 63 million people in a country of 330 million to be part of the 1%. And then the rationalizations begin, which is, well, a lot of these Trump supporters, they were actually supporters of the socialist senator Bernie Sanders, but they were disappointed when he didn't get the nomination, and so they revolted. Well, then, there were Black supporters of Bernie Sanders, and we didn't revolt and vote for the right. That never comes up. I guess they're still thinking this is a white man's republic, I guess. And so you get this sort of rationalizing of class collaboration and participation in class collaboration. And this obviously leaves the Black population and other peoples of color out in the cold. And fortunately, in the past, what we've been able to do is organize internationally to put pressure on the US authorities. And fortunately, some of our international friends and supporters have been more insightful with regard to this country than people who live here. I'm thinking of the Irish patriot Daniel O'Connell, who I think was in the 1830s, said that the successful rebels against British rule in 1776 had replaced the aristocracy of lineage with the aristocracy of, quote, race, unquote. Or that they had replaced the tyranny of monarchy with the tyranny of racism. And that's a very insightful analysis. But the tragedy is that sort of analysis still hasn't taken hold, not least in a significant percentage of the US population who consider themselves to be radical. It's really quite astonishing if you think about it.
No, I mean, absolutely. And I think that, really importantly to this as well, and we can kind of look at this in the more global level, but also just to see how people try to so easily disentangle or ignore the racial component of capitalist exploitation as it evolved in the US and then internationally. I mean, some of the, original techniques that have been now, used in terms of the managing of corporate capitalist subjects, wage laborers, was made in the plantation economy. So in a sense, this is part of the DNA of our national and international oppression. But I wanted to also ask you, in terms of looking at this internationally, that you do a fantastic job in your work of showing how you can't really separate racism in the US and racism globally because there's just connected, right? Like that things like, for instance, if you look at, Jim Crow, right? That's connected to things that are happening in Cuba. So I was wondering how this also helps us then to rearticulate these struggles, but also rearticulate how we understand where U.S. racism comes from and what its very basis is.
Well, in part, I deal with that in my 16th century book. And once again, let me state one of the theses of the 16th century book, and you'll see it's really rather simple. And if you think about it, it's rather obvious, which then makes you wonder why it really hasn't been stated, at least not forcefully. That is to say that post-1492, you see that the Iberians, particularly the Spanish, they have a first mover's advantage. And they also have a religious qualification for settlement. You have to be religiously correct, basically. And that also helps to point out the difference between, say, Cuba and the mainland of North America, because from the inception of the Spanish invasion of Cuba in the 1500s, you had Africans who were Catholic who were free and played a significant and disproportionate role in the military in Cuba from the inception. And then what's happening is that how is it then that I'm sitting in North America now speaking English? I mean, what happened? Well, what happened is quite simple. As I'm sure many of your audience know, London, or at least the monarchy, opted for the Protestant then sect in the 1530s. And this leads to a spate of religious conflicts. A high point, or I should say a low point, comes in the 1572, as I recall, with the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, when in a maneuver that settlers then practiced on Native Americans here in North America, the Catholics invited Protestants to a meeting in France and then fell upon them and massacred thousands, perhaps tens of thousands. And of course, the Spanish wanted to dislodge the Queen in London. And of course, a turning point comes, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in 1588, when the Spanish Armada is thwarted in terms of an invasion of England. So what happens is that the English, the scrappy underdogs, they were under the gun, they were under siege. And so rather than using religion as a qualifier, because of course they were from a minority, a Protestant sect, they basically broadened the base for settler colonialism by extending it to pan-Europeanism, which morphs into whiteness, which then morphs into white supremacy. So, as I point out in the book, even though London had expelled the Jewish population in 1291, and of course, as you know, the Spanish did in 1492, the L London and the English settlers opened their embrace to Jewish settlers, even though there had been these murderous conflicts between Protestant English and Irish Catholics. London opened its embrace to Irish Catholic settlers. And in part, of course, it's not as if, it was the difference between living in New York and living in London. I mean, they were going into the unknown, having to face rambunctious indigenous populations and then intended by oftentimes rebellious Africans who were part of the package. And so this was seen as a dangerous mission, if not a fool's errand. And so if you look at my 17th century book, I talk about how the establishment of Maryland in the midpoint of the 17th century, it's basically established by what you could call British Catholics. The Spanish did not go there as late as 1819, 1820, when Stephen F. Austin, of course, the capital of Texas is now named after him, Austin, Texas, was negotiating with the Spanish, then independent Mexico, about settling in what was then Mexican territory. They had to profess Catholicism. And of course, that was not necessary with regard to the English settlers. And of course, that's encapsulated in the vaunted First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which
projects this idea of freedom of religion, and which many scholars have told us was sort of the capstone of Enlightenment thought. But another way to look at it is the capstone of settler colonialism. That is to say, you broaden the base of settler colonialism by moving away from the narrow category of religion to the broader category of pan-Europeanism, or perhaps the broader category of race. And as I point out in the opening pages of the 16th century book, one of the problems we have had, particularly those on the losing end of this concept of race, say Black people, for example, is that it has these religious roots, which means that there's a certain lack of rationality, to speak euphemistically. And there have been arguments by other scholars that lynchings, this rather crude enterprise of murdering Black men in particular without due process of law, which many in your audience may have witnessed as recently as May 25th, 2020, with the killing of George Floyd, that historically these lynchings, according to the historian Donald Matthews, were akin to religious sacraments. There are burnings of crosses, there are thousands and hundreds of people there. There are symbolic dismembering of the victim, with people keeping elements of that person's body, which still exists, by the way, if they haven't decomposed. That is to say, the digits in every sense of the term, of the individual who is dismembered. And so, as I said in opening this particular segment, it's obvious that we have to explain how the English were able to overcome the Spanish, who had first mover's advantage. And unfortunately, that kind of inquiry really hasn't been in the forefront. And part of it has to do with the way the historical enterprise works in this country, whereby individuals study a piece of the puzzle, but don't necessarily look at the broader picture. Like they'll study, how shoestrings were manufactured in France in 1784. And that's it. I mean, they'll spend 30 years studying that subject and don't look at the bigger picture. And so we need more historians in the United States who try to look at the bigger picture. And of course, we need more historians in the United States in particular who try to give us a critical analysis of U.S. imperialism.
One of the, and I hope you don't mind, this is a bit of a deep dive into your recent book and just some of the things you've done. But you have this wonderful phrase when it comes to actually thinking about whiteness as part of the process of colonialism, which is a kind of dulling of class antagonisms. And what you mean there, and not to put words in your mouth, so please tell me if I'm not fully capturing it, but it's a very interesting dynamic where actually the construction of whiteness was always this project of opening up diversity in one realm so that you could dull class antagonisms, create logics of equivalences, in a sense, and then marshal that and weaponize that against, other groups, particularly in this case, non-whites. And I'm thinking that you talk about this, as you've kind of just alluded to in your last answer, in terms of the ways in which this kind of pan-Europeanism that was very, part of the English liberal tradition and things like freedom of religion was actually a way in which to move beyond religious sectarianism to this ability to actually make settlers feel as if they were part of the same class, as if there was a universalism. And I think that this has serious resonance with, something much more recent, which is the ways in which right after the Second World War, you see an expansion of whiteness to all of a sudden take in these kind of different ethnicities that traditionally were seen as either lower white or, if you're, for instance, Italians, not white at all. And I was wondering if you would, take this in any direction you wanted, but talk about this continual cycle that seems to occur in terms of settler colonialism, capitalism, and racialization, in which you have this continual process of dulling class antagonisms through, if you will, values of diversity, values of openness, values of freedom, obviously for some, but nevertheless, that there's this really interesting dynamic that when we think of things like racism, we oftentimes think of just prejudice, but it also has this other dulling part of opening the space and opening the privileged identity to previously marginalized groups.
Well, I was thinking the other day, and I should have written it in the book, but it just occurred to me that the United States, in many ways, was a precursor of the European Union. That is to say, that those in this category of whiteness, it include it's a very heterogeneous grouping. I mean, it includes English, Irish, Scots, Welsh, Germans, Poles, Romanians, Russians, Croats, Serbians, Northern Italians, Southern Italians, Northern French, Southern French. And it's rather ironic that London, which in some ways pioneered in creating this European Union, is now enmeshed in Brexit.
Yes.
I mean, there must be a connection there somehow. Now, my next job is to figure out what the connection between those two is, and perhaps you can add to that.
I definitely would have some ideas on that. But I think a lot of it is the ways in which once you establish a quote unquote diverse identity, it then becomes reified into something that needs to be protected. And therefore, it becomes, in a sense, an ability to become sectarian yourself and become protectionist and become essentialist in that respect. That could then be, again, weaponized in very interesting and often unpredictable ways that is for the perpetuation of capitalism, but also against localized capitalist elites, such as in the EU.
Well, see, another aspect of it as well. I know that at least in certain circles in France, there has been an idea of France strengthening its own position by having some sort of Mediterranean Union, for example, that France would dominate. And that reminds me also that this concept of whiteness in the United States has been very capacious, and I think that's been a part of the propaganda. Because you have Lebanese Christians who are defined as white. Ralph Nader, is Lebanese Christian descent. Not necessarily Lebanese Muslims. I'm not so sure about them. You have Iranian Jewish populations. There are many in Los Angeles, for example, that's called Teherangeles, that are defined as quote white unquote. I'm not so well. I'm not so sure about Iranian Muslims, but maybe them too. But I certainly Iranian Jewish. So it's been a very elastic, plastic category, and I think that then that feeds the propaganda about small d democracy and how opening,
Yes.
welcoming the United States is. All these people, they get off the boat and they do well. They forget about the poor Negroes and the poor Native Americans. Somehow
Absolutely.
they don't enter to the picture. But it also, and one of your comments too, I wrote a book on boxing, which will be out in a few months.
Wow.
And one of the things about boxing in the United States is that, say, before 1945, many of the best boxers or Jewish Americans. And after 1945, with the Saul on the Road to Damascus conversion of the US ruling class and the pressure from the socialist camp and the rise of the anti-colonial movement in Africa and the Caribbean in particular, and the United States found it difficult to continue to treat people of color in such an atrocious manner. And this leads to an opening. But the opening also allows for a certain kind of class mobility for the Jewish population. So you see that many of the Jewish American men who would have become boxers, they become managers, they become referees, they become promoters. Many of them make a lot of money. I mean, look at Bob Arum, Arum, for example, who is still the titan of the sport. And there has been an inadequate attention, it seems to me, to that phenomenon, that opening up phenomenon that particularly encompasses Jewish Americans. And I should also say that with regard to what becomes the U.S. project, it has many, many roots. And in my 17th century book, I point to 1676. I think the chapter is called The Spirit of 1676. It's a play on the spirit of 1776. Because this is the time when you have slave revolts in the Caribbean, particularly Barbados, of African slaves, enslaved Africans. Then you have rebellions in what they call New England, with the Native Americans on the warpath about to oust the settlers. And then in Virginia, you have Bacon's Rebellion, whereby Nathaniel Bacon, a man of means, organizes a complement, a group of men who are mostly not of means, and they engage in this cross-class coalition to overthrow the London's rule in that settlement, because they felt London wasn't moving rapidly enough to take the land from the Native Americans and redistribute it to themselves. Now, what's interesting is that you've had many so-called progressive historians who see that as a real leap forward. I mean, they forget about the Native Americans. I mean, that's another thing. The whole question of land and the Native Americans lose their... And in fact, right now, I'm afraid to say this. So the U.S. Supreme Court just the other day issued an opinion where they said that half of Oklahoma belongs to Native Americans. And as I said on a radio commentary about this, it really cast a shadow over one of the U.S. left's main anthems, which is "This land is your land, this land is my land," from California to the New York High Line. It says, no, this land is their land. And what's curious, this is a footnote, is that that song, of course, comes from the heralded Woody Guthrie, who had roots in Oklahoma. But in some ways, now the U.S. Supreme Court and the ultimate conservative body is to the left. The U.S. on the question of land, which is a fundamental question.
Yes.
So I say all this to say we got a lot of work to do.
I mean, one of the interesting things about your two books kind of going back to, you know, the 16th century and the 17th century, and I bring this up because I think it shows the many roots of the U.S. project. And you mentioned like France and this idea of constructing a Mediterranean, if you will, union, is that when we think of colonialism and imperialism, and I think you do this so wonderfully in your work, is that we also have to think about this as plural. So what was, you know, the Spanish Empire was, you know, had similar logics of imperialism, but was a quite different cultural project than what you see in the UK. And one of the books that I've never written, I probably never will, but I always wanted to, was to actually take seriously what the French imperial project offered the US. Because if you look at the English imperial project, in many ways, a lot of the reasons that the Constitution reads so much like a legal document, in many ways, Declaration of Independence, is because for them, it's in many ways an expansive legal empire with clear rules of race and exploitation. Whereas for the French, and you see this in the EU now with the Francophones, you know, influence still incredibly important. It's a project of what would morph into republicanism. It's a civilizing process. And you see these two, and I put that in quotes, obviously, but you see these very interesting kind of aspects, even within some of the founding fathers. So, I mean, on the one hand, Thomas Jefferson on one day would kind of say, you know, we have universal rights that, you know, need to be legally applied, but they can't be legally applied if you're not rational enough to take them on. And that's why, you know, the white race is able to be managers and part of productive. I mean, he was a huge Lockean, right? And on other days, it's very civilized. I'm like, well, maybe in generations, they can free themselves, right? And I'm kind of wondering about the ways in which really looking at some of these things and understanding how the settler colonialism has common, if you will, underlying structures in terms of they're about exploitation, they're about racialization, they're about class, but quite different superstructures that aren't always easily compatible. And I'm kind of wondering in many ways how you kind of see, and I know this is a big question, but I very rarely get on one of my true intellectual heroes like you, so I'll put it out there and feel free to say it's a Monday. I'm not sure if I feel like answering so much, but is that, what do you see in terms of this kind of melting pot of imperial projects that the US has drawn upon that the US has kind of now, and I hate to use this term, but kind of offered the world as its almost unique imperial superstructure project and culture, right?
Well, that's when you were speaking, I couldn't get out of my mind the idea of the French Protestants and the French Huguenots, so-called, who played a preeminent role in the rise of London. Because after 1572, for example, many of them crossed the Channel into London and become quite successful. If you go through the cemetery in Charleston, South Carolina today, for example, you'll see on the many of the headstones French names. They're all French Huguenots, deceased French Huguenots. And we really need a deeper analysis of how this, what eventuates in the US project, draws upon varied and diverse European projects, not only the English project and not only the French Protestant project, but as some have pointed out, drawing upon the Scottish project, for example. Oftentimes there's this mistaken notion that John F. Kennedy was the first Irish president in 1960. He was actually the first Irish Catholic president because many of a whole slew of US presidents have basically been Ulstermen. And so, therefore, in order to understand the history of the United States, it might be useful to do an intense study of Northern Ireland, for example, and the conflicts there in Northern Ireland going back decades, if not centuries. And I think you could sort of go down the line with regard to the various streams from Europe that have come to comprise what is called the white population. You've seen that Washington has drawn upon, like it's a buffet of various aspects of these diverse European cultures. And I'm hoping that some intellectuals in your audience will take up that idea, because I think it could be very fruitful when explored.
One of the things, and I agree, and I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's one of the projects that I'm also trying to think about is really tracing out the, if you will, melting pot culture of America, of US imperialism, and in a way, how it's almost commodified it as like you said, a buffet of resources of cultures in which to draw upon and marshal when necessary. I wanted to go in a slightly different direction and ask you though about something that I think is actually quite relevant now that hasn't necessarily been taken up so much, which is you wrote, gosh, it's only been 3 years ago, but you've written so much even since then. But you wrote a really nice book that I enjoyed on the Associated Negro Press. And
Oh,
yeah, it's a great book. I really liked it. But I thought that this was going to be a really kind of, celebratory book or also a book that was just about co-optation. But as you usually do, you kind of said there's a really more interesting story here. And I'll let you allow to kind of tell if you want some of the context and background. But what's important here is that you say you can look at, one of the key people in it, Claude Albert Barnet, and say he's actually a victim of his own success because
that's right.
actually, the danger that really happened wasn't all the complexities and the palace intrigues and the ways in which, there was this tension between how radical this was going to be and how capitalist. It was really when the mainstream press started actually reporting on racism, that's when all of a sudden, in many ways, both in terms of the capital that was funding it, the institutions that was doing it, and also the gaze that it was seen through, really started to eliminate or dismantle Black news and Black reporting on these things and a Black voice in these in reporting about US racism. And I bring that up because obviously you can fill in some of the blanks and you're a great historian, so I'm sure you have all sorts of interesting stories about this. But that paradox that, what you have is an almost subaltern group working so hard in order to raise these issues. But the minute that they raise these issues is then the danger in which they become not only co-opted, but reconfigured into, if you will, the gaze of the colonizer, right? The gaze of the power. And I'm wondering, with things like Black Lives Matters right now, particularly, and I'm going to apologize to my listeners and to you. I mean, this is where you're going to see my old school communist part come out. Without a disciplined party to help to, assert this and help to maintain this kind of both on the ground things, but also coming up with, organic intellectual, understandings and insights on this. How can we avoid the same thing happening? Because I've seen this happening quite a bit, and more than just, Rachel Maddow and MSNBC kind of doing the bidding of the CIA and doing all the sorts of interesting and then funnily quickly debunked reporting about how evil Putin is. Not that I support Putin, but on a more fundamental level, that, it's almost like history repeating that this is exactly the tipping point in which these types of movements become not merely co-opted, but recolonized.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
I apologize.
Let me just start with Claude Burnett. So he starts this Associated Negro Press. It's like an equivalent of Reuters or the Associated Press in the United States. It's a news agency. They have correspondents all over the world, particularly in the Pan-African world. And from the, say, about 1919 up until the 1960s, they're filing reports on a regular basis that's distributed to the black press, which is still a very formidable enterprise in the United States. And despite the internet, I think it's still possible to say that a close reader of the black press in the 1940s could be more intelligent and more knowledgeable about global affairs than some person today who has a sound internet connection. However, he's an entrepreneur, and there hangs a tail. Because in one part of the book, he's in one letter, he's reprimanding the Belgian colonizers in Congo about their depredations. And then you get down to about the fourth or fifth paragraph, he says, "Oh, by the way, I like this Congolese sculpture. So can you give me a deal on something?" So it illustrates the contradictions of black capitalism. I mean, on the one hand, because his readers are hungry for stories about colonialism and the fight against colonialism, and want their leaders, so-called like Barnett, to speak out against it, so he does that. But then he's an entrepreneur; he's trying to make money, and so the latter, trying to make money, then gives the Belgians a way to co-opt him. But as your comment suggested, the ultimate demise of his enterprise comes because he's trying to knock down the walls of Jim Crow, which is largely a successful project for reasons having to do a lot with the international situation already alluded to, the rise of national liberation movements, the strength of the socialist camp, et cetera. But when that happens, of course, the New York Times can offer some of his best reporters better deals than he can. And then the New York Times begins to expand their remit to cover issues that they theretofore had ignored, which then erodes him his base further. And then he tries to move into Africa. But on the one hand, he wants to be a kind of servant of US imperialism in Africa. But that doesn't go down very well with the African nations. And then they really want to develop their own news agency. And so he's on all sides. So it really is a story about the contradictions of black capitalism in the United States, or really sort of a illustrative story of the subaltern. Now, getting to Black Lives Matter, obviously there's a problem with decentralization, which is their model. But of course, that model arose because when you have centralized organizations like the Black Panther Party, for example, which too focused on issues of police terror, their leaders were harassed, intimidated, sometimes killed, like Fred Hampton and Mark Clark on December 4th, 1969, in their beds in Chicago. And of course, there are still Black Panthers who are in prison to this very day. So then you have this adaptation to that horror show by being decentralized. But of course, that model has inherent weaknesses. I mean, it's hard to plan. For example, you open yourselves up. I mean, there's this Black Lives Matter Foundation, which has been exposed in Southern California, which is raising millions of dollars, although it's not clear where the money is going. So, and it's difficult to have a spokesperson who even progressive press can reach out to. And so, and then of course, you know, the history of these decentralized movements have not been very promising. But that's where we are right now, I'm afraid to say. And, you know, we're still early in the moment. I mean, this is July, and the moment has since kicked off on May 25th with the lynching of George Floyd. But we'll see what happens. I mean, we'll see what kind of momentum can be generated and what can arise to compensate for the weaknesses of the Black Lives Matter movement, because I think that there's so much anger and fury with regard to police terror. I mean, you have new words, new phrases that are now invading the vocabulary. For example, the latest one is vehicular terrorism. This is when police officers or even civilians drive their cars into a bevy of peaceful protesters, killing people. I mean, we have scores of examples of vehicular terrorism in the United States in recent weeks. So these new situations, it seems to me, create new opportunities and give rise to new organizational forms, just as Black Lives Matter filled the vacuum that was created when centralized organizations like the Black Panther Party were bludgeoned to submission.
And one of the things that I think is also kind of quite interesting about this is that, you know this history so much better than me. And you know, obviously, you can feel so much inspiration about the Black Lives Matters. But I found it interesting about even now how there's still the framing of the debate as an insurrection, an uprising. And what this does in my mind is kind of situates it as, you know, just some, you know, not isolated unrest, but almost a spontaneous unrest, as opposed to something that had been building, not just in terms of the oppression that was being felt, not just in terms of the police terror, but also in terms of a serious intellectual engagement that often wasn't seen, to be honest, within white power structures and white knowledge, but about, you know, things like abolitionism, things like defunding the police, which, you know, we're seeing aren't actually that radical, and actually we have to be careful because can easily fit within a liberal capitalist paradigm. Whereas one thing that is forgotten, I think, now about the Black Panthers was that they were very, you know, not to reify them, but they were a nationalist revolutionary movement that had, you know, programs all over the country, but was also very particular about, we are going to reframe the debate so that if things like riots happen, we're not going to allow you to simply say they are these isolated spontaneous events. These are part of a movement. And I do get a little bit worried because sometimes when I hear things like this is an insurrection or let's tear down the statues, which is a great symbolic gesture, obviously, it is this kind of mentality that is very much based, I think, in settler colonialism and, you know, racialized capitalism of how do we manage and contain this?
Well, I mean, with regard to the Black Panthers, for example, they were also internationalists, which I think was part of the secret to their success. I mean, they had mission in Algeria. They had delegates in France. They had delegates in Cuba, for example. Now, in my biography of the Black communist leader, William Patterson, I give an idea of how that all falls apart, not only because of the hammer blows of the state, but also because of certain internal contradictions as well that did not play out to their advantage. But, and I think you have a bit of that with regard to the movement today. I mean, for example, even though it didn't get that much publicity, there was a real significant event a few weeks ago at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, where the African Union filed a motion on behalf of Black Americans calling for a commitment of inquiry into systemic racism in the United States. Now, you haven't anything like that since 1963, when the Organization of African Unity, as it was then called, was being founded in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. And they were objecting in no certain terms to what was unfolding in the streets of Birmingham, where you had German Shepherd dogs attacking children, for example. So this was indicative of the changing correlation of forces globally. And there was some interesting journalism about this, where the United States tried to downplay it. It's like the metaphor about the duck. When you see it on the pond, it seems to be gliding along in a placid manner, but below the surface, his feet are paddling furiously. Well, that describes the United States when this motion was filed, because they tried to be cool about it, placid about it. Behind the scenes, they were lobbying furiously. They were twisting arms. And of course, the motion did not pass. But it is a harbinger, I think, of things to come. And with regard to tearing down the statue, see now the issue is getting to the so-called founding fathers. For example, if you're objecting to slavery and slave owners, well, what about these statues to Jefferson and Washington, for example? And then you get into these contradictions about the so-called Confederate States of America and the leaders. They thought that they were clearly walking in the footsteps of Jefferson and Washington, who seceded from the British Empire, after all, not least because of slavery. And the Confederate States of America was seceding from the United States, not least because of the question of slavery. And so all of these issues are sort of coming to a head, and it's putting a lot of pressure on elite propagandists and spokespersons. Mm-hmm. For example, the latest case comes in Harper's Magazine, where you had the so-called great and the good write this letter complaining about what they call cancel culture, which is basically an attempt of movements from below to try to attack racism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and other ills. And what's interesting is that many of the people who signed this letter, such as David Brooks, a columnist for the New York Times, he engages in cancel culture all the time. I mean, when Bernie Sanders seemed to be surging, this is a socialist senator from Vermont who was challenging for the Democratic nomination for president. David Brooks wrote this column, Never Bernie. You know, he went to cancel all the movement. And of course, socialists in the United States are canceled so often, it's like normative. It's like breathing. It happens all the time. And so now that question of elite gatekeepers is being challenged, all of a sudden we have this phrase cancel culture, which is a way to put the progressive forces, those to the left of liberalism, in fact, in their place. And given the correlation of forces in the United States, it's unclear how this is going to eventuate.
And it was interesting just on that letter, because I think that points to something, which is, you know, how do you take seriously a letter that was signed by someone like Barry Weiss, who like literally was engaged not just in cancel culture, but like in a campaign to have, you know, Arab professors fired for doing history about Israel, right? Like literally that's what she did at Columbia when she was a student. I mean, when you say, I mean, and I was very, you know, struck by that, you know, this was a situation in which, you know, you didn't see anything in that letter about actual left-wing professors who have been fired, who've lost their jobs. And I also think about it that, you know, this is perhaps a little bit of a tangent and we'll give a thing, but it's like, no one's canceling Steven Pinker. He's just a bad scum. It's not canceling to be, as we say in academia, reviewer number two and say your statistics are wrong and even the UN agrees with that now. That's just saying you're not a good scholar. So I think that was really correct in the sense that, as you said, that this is a situation in which it wasn't about free speech. It was about people who aren't used to being held accountable are suddenly held accountable. And
well,
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I mean, it's even worse. I mean, if you look at the engineers behind this letter, on the one hand, there's this Ivy League professor by Mark Lilla, who after Trump got elected, he wrote first an op-ed for the New York Times, which he stretched into a book, which I guess will help his case to get a merit raise, that says, you know who elected Trump? Black Lives Matter. He said, the Negroes voted against Trump 9-1, and Black Lives Matter people didn't like Trump. So how do they? Oh, it's because of its identity politics, which so outraged the Euro-American majority that they rose up as one to put a right-wing populace in the White House. Then another engineer of this ill-fated letter was Thomas Chatterton Williams, who could be described as a light-skinned Negro who lives in France, and wrote an entire book about how unfairly he's described as a black person. Boo-hoo, boo-hoo. So then one of their cases has to do with James Bennett, the former editorial page director of the New York Times, who published, without reading it, an op-ed from Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who is a Neanderthal in his thinking, no insult to our Neanderthal brothers and sisters, by the way, who call for the military to intervene to stop these protests in June 2020, mm-hmm. protest George Floyd's killing. And so, you know, many black employees at the New York Times objected. They don't have the muscle to overthrow the editorial page director. He obviously lost the support of the publisher, Sulzberger, which is why he had to step down. But so basically what they're objecting to is you're not supposed to object to any sort of travesty that these elite propagandists put forward. You're supposed to accept it supinely. And then if you do object and you have impact, you're part of cancel culture. It's ludicrous.
And I mean, absolutely. Like, and I think that's a good thing in terms of going from objection to, you know, in the possibility of objection to even something more hopeful for a second. And maybe I'm being very from the US here in terms of trying to kind of end at a place of hope. But I did want to talk to you about this one thing that I found very interesting, which is that if you look at some of the autonomous zones like CHOP, and this is something that I'm personally also interested in, because I write about and, you know, common-based cultures and, you know, common-based economies and the dialectic in terms of this. But, you know, this was an attempt actually to go beyond just resistance, so to speak, but to actually form spaces of alternative freedom, right? And I was interested because there's a long history of this in abolitionism, obviously, mm-hmm. from Moorish cultures to, you know, even the kind of people, you know, forget about the Barbary Pirates, but this, a huge part of that was, you know, the US, even from the very beginning, could not handle black spaces of freedom if they existed around the world. But when I read your book about jazz, I thought, and this happens a lot when I read your book, so I apologize. And maybe it's because I don't read them as I should, but I thought I was gonna get this fantastic history of jazz, which I do. But what I also found was that so much of it is almost a forensic analysis of the ways in which, in order to, you know, be creative, in order to have a culture of cultural flourishing in a quite exploitive and racist capitalist society, you have to develop radical skills of survival. Mm-hmm. Develop radical ways of building external and internal spaces to be free. And this goes all the way from, you know, the playing of music itself in this case to, you know, you have to learn to be, quote unquote, an entrepreneur to open a club, right? Because who's going to, otherwise, where are you going to play, right? You have to learn how to know when the police are going to raid certain clubs or not. So you have to learn these types of things. And I'm wondering in, you know, this is a big topic, but I want to, because I really, you know, felt interested in this, is that how do you think you can take struggles like this in order to begin learning the types of radical skills that are going to be necessary to building an alternative society? One that goes beyond just having, like, you know, a center left like Bernie Sanders one day elected president.
Well, it's like the old slogan, building as we fight. I mean, I think that when you were talking about that music book, I was thinking about the Debut Records, which was started by the bassist Charles Mingus and the drummer Max Roach in the 1950s. But then again, how difficult it was, not only because many of these musicians, they were practicing 13, 14 hours a day, believe it or not, when they weren't gigging, when they weren't playing a job for pay. And it's like it's oftentimes said about chess players, you know, with all respect, that in order to be good at chess, oftentimes you have to let other skills deteriorate. Mm-hmm. Because it's so demanding and it takes so much time. And I would say the same for these musicians, that it was very difficult for them to construct these alternative spaces. And I haven't even gotten into fighting organized crime, for example, or fighting other vipers in the commercial world. But they had to build as they were fighting. And I think that's true for many of us. You know, we're fighting, but you have to try to build something, build a political organization. And of course, ideally you build a political organization that's a fighting organization. And then, of course, many of them, I'm afraid to say, found that the better part of wisdom was to go into exile. But even in exile, I think there's a long history of not only Black people going into exile, but progressive people going into exile. But I don't really see that, as, and I'm sure you know, as a defeat. Because when folks in the 1850s went into exile in Canada, it's not like they were divorced from the struggle against slavery. In fact, John Brown's raid in 1859 was which was an attempt for the armed overthrow of slavery in the western section of Virginia, was basically cooked up in Canada. So, and of course, many of these musicians, you know, Dexter Gordon winds up in Copenhagen, R. Farmer winds up in Vienna. Many people are going into Western Europe all the time. My brother is a musician, and he makes enough money for an extended stint in Japan that allows him to live in the United States for an extended period of time. So, you know, this struggle in this right-wing bastion is very complicated. Hopefully, we're at an inflection point with the May 25th protests. And hopefully, from now going forward, we'll just go from strength to strength and victory to victory.
I hope so too, and that's a really inspiring place, I think, to end. Professor Horn, I mean, thank you so much for coming on. There's so many books I would say for people to read, but please look up if you haven't had a chance to read his work, because I think it's incredibly important. And your latest book, The Dawning of the Apocalypse, it's a wonderful book, and thank you so much for coming on. There is another world that's possible and another world to win, and you are such a key part of it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Another World is Possible. My name is Peter Bloom, and remember, until next time, another world is not only possible, but happening right now.